supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we have gotten a barrage of emails lately asking me to, quote, correct my mistake of calling old railroad ties illegal to use in the home landscape. We'll respond to those emails in the question of the week format after a bunch of your well-formatted phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joel, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Joel. Where are you, sir?
Well, actually, I'm in Florida, but I visit my son in Raleigh, North Carolina quite often, and that's why I'm calling. I'm hoping you can tell me that I didn't kill his beautiful willow tree.
Okay, a willow tree, huh? Okay, does he live near the water?
No, he lives in Apex. There's actually a stream out in the back, but he's got several willow trees on his property, and this particular one is on a slope. There was a very low-hanging limb. I call it a limb because it was about 4 inches thick, and I cut it off with a chainsaw.
Ooh.
And, yeah, I know. I don't like the sound of that, Mike. Well, this limb was too thick to cut any other way, and it was really obscene. Just kind of, I've got a new grandson, and it was blocking the use of the yard because it was just hanging right in the middle of the back garden. And so he said, just cut it off. And I said, okay, that seems easy enough. So I chopped it off. And now the limb that I cut it off of is clearly, well, it's not growing anything and there's no leaves left on it. And now the whole tree appears to be dying. I don't know if it's just dormant now or in shock or what.
Was this a weeping willow?
Yes.
So all the branches were kind of hanging down.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, all of the branches are hanging down, but this particular limb had grown out, you know, and it was quite large in diameter, and it had grown right over the back garden, so it was really in the way.
Yeah, probably the worst thing might have been the timing. When did you commit your crime here, Joel?
In May.
You know, that's not the worst time of the year. I thought you were going to tell me you did it like a couple of months ago, you know, in that like heat sink of July or August. When you used the chainsaw, did you take off an entire branch, an entire limb?
Yeah, right back to the limb that it was coming off of.
Now
which was not the main trunk of the tree. This limb came off the trunk, and then the limb I cut off was coming off of that secondary limb.
Okay, so we've got obviously the trunk of the tree, and then we've got a branch coming out, and what you cut off was a secondary branch?
Yes.
How did the first branch end, the one that you theoretically didn't cut?
Well, the one that I cut it off of is still there, and it grows virtually straight up. It's quite high. It's about, I suppose, 25 feet off of the ground at the end of it, you know, at the peak.
Okay. And it only accounts for what portion of the tree? 5%, 20%?
Oh, I think probably it was about 20%.
Okay.
Like that.
Okay. So the tree was in a little bit of shock and nobody sprayed herbicides in the area. Nobody treated a lawn right underneath the tree right after this or anything?
No, but he has cut back watering the lawn because he's going to have sod put down here in like another month or so. So he has stopped watering the back lawn, and that tree might, although when it rains, all the water rushes right to the trunk of the tree.
I think you just nailed it. After you took off that branch, which was going to increase the amount of water the tree would shed, let's say, you know, the tree was no longer sealed. It couldn't retain all its moisture. And, you know, willows are very water hungry. The worst thing you could do then is distress the tree by underwatering it. So I think that's what's going on.
I see.
And even this late in the game, I would at least, you know, take a hose out, which I would have recommended back in May. Just drag a hose out to the tree and let it drip at the base of the tree. It wouldn't have to necessarily soak the sod. But, sure. Yeah, I think the combination of taking off that much, which is theoretically okay, but then not watering the tree afterwards and perhaps the weather turning dry down there, put it into a little bit of shock. But if it gets enough water, hopefully it should come back next year.
Well, I hope so, because my son is going to disown me if it dies.
That's interesting. I've never heard of that working in reverse. He's going to write himself out of the will. That'll show you.
Exactly.
All right. Well, tell him to get some moisture to the base of that tree and think good thoughts, Joel.
All right, Mike, and thank you very much. I appreciate your show.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marlene, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Marlene. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you. I listen to your show a lot. Like it a lot.
Very good. And where is Marlene?
Newtown Square, Pennsylvania.
All right. What can we do for Marlene in Newtown Square?
I grew a big, beautiful, and very happy spider plant outside all summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to bring it in, and when I brought in a similar size last year, it died almost immediately. So what can I do to adjust it to being inside so I can keep it alive? Because it is huge. It is really beautiful.
Marlene, you win a special prize. Spider plants are not even supposed to be capable of death.
I know. I mean, I've had dead ones come back in the spring. This one last year, literally, it just died immediately, almost.
I don't know
if it was the spot or what it was.
Is it outside or inside still?
It's still outside.
Okay, good. And you'll bring it in before the nights get too cold.
Yeah, I figure it has at least another 3 or 4 weeks to go.
Okay. Better to err on the side of caution, you know, because they are tropical plants. They don't have any sense of humor about nights in the 40s.
Okay.
Yeah. So what kind of pot is it in? What kind of medium is it in?
I just replanted it in, I think, a plastic hanging pot.
Good.
It's not hanging now, but it was plastic when I got it, and I think that's what I replanted it in.
Okay, good.
Okay.
So what kind of situation was the one in that expired last winter?
So I brought it in. It was also south-facing, but not getting any direct sun.
Mm-hmm.
Next to a window, but not a lot of sun comes in, and what does comes in for a lot less time.
Right.
And the only other facing I have would be east, because I live in a townhouse. There's no north or south window.
Right. No, my house faces north on all four sides. It's a terrible choice for a gardener. And was the dead plant hanging over like a radiator or a heat vent or anything like that?
No, and there wouldn't have been any heat on in the house when I brought it in last October. It was on kind of like a pedestal.
And
I would say it was maybe 2 feet away from the window.
And you say it died how quickly?
Really fast. Leaves started turning brown and drooping almost immediately.
And what kind of water situation? How do you water your plants?
Probably weekly.
And what do you do specifically?
Just water.
But how do you handle the overflow and stuff like that?
No overflow.
Okay. Are you going to hang it or are you going to put it on another pedestal?
I was going to do the same thing. I just wasn't sure if I should adjust it to less light a little bit at a time or just bring it in immediately and just let it adjust right away.
And what kind of light is it getting outside?
Filtered. Well, right now it's in direct sunlight afternoon.
Okay. Until you're ready to bring it in, why don't you move it into dappled shade, let it get adjusted? But I don't think that's what happened. I mean, they're very tough plants. I've never even seen them go through. You know, ficus typically will drop all their leaves. Philodendrons will drop a lot of their leaves when they come inside, you know, but not spider plants. So I'm not quite sure what happened last year, but let's put it on a pedestal. If you want to put it in the other location, I think you're saying it's going to get about the same amount of light, but differently?
Yeah, it's going to be filtered through a blind.
And on the other side, it's not?
The other side is east, and there are windows in the front that do get good light. I mean, I have a lot of jade plants there, and they like it up there, over there.
Okay. No, that sounds good. And your jade plants are doing well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so maybe you have an overly light hand with the water in relationship to the spider plant. The easiest way to kill a jade plant is with water. But spider plants, especially if they're actively growing, they got a lot of those parachutes, they got a lot of babies, they can be thirsty plants. So when you put it up on the pedestal, see how it feels. Feel the weight of the container. You know what I mean? Rock it back and forth.
Okay.
And then get like a quart of water and put a little bit of water in, say a quarter of the quart, and walk away for like 20 minutes. Then come back and do that again. And do that like a little bit every half hour until you start to see water coming out of the base.
Okay.
And then rock that plant again. And then you will know what it feels like, both dry and saturated. In the future, because the humidity of your home could have an awful lot to do with this, water by the weight of the pot. If the pot feels heavy, don't add water. But if the pot feels light, even if it seems too soon, it simply means the plant is taking up a lot of water and you should water it again.
All right, great. Thanks, I will do that.
All right, good luck, Marlene.
Thanks for your help.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Fredericksburg, Virginia Home and Garden Show on Saturday and Sunday, October 15th and 16th, and at the Huntington Valley Library on Sunday afternoon, October 23rd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with bad wood, unenforced laws, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we have gotten a flurry of emails from all over the country demanding that I retract my previous statement that it is illegal to use old railroad ties in a home landscape environment. We'll investigate that issue after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Gwen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Gwen. How are you?
I'm doing rather well.
And where is Gwen doing well?
Gwen is in Michigan.
Okay, what part of Michigan?
Lincoln Park, just south of Detroit.
Oh, okay, excellent. What can we do for Gwen in Lincoln Park?
Well, in 1990, I moved into my new home and wanted an herb garden. So I picked several herbs and planted them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the herbs was garlic chives. I liked them for the fact that they went to bloom early, and it was attractive in the garden. The problem is now a third of my yard is taken over with garbage chives, and I can't get them to stop rooting under the ground and popping up 3-6 feet more away from where the herb garden was. I don't know how to control them. I can't corral them. They're everywhere.
Well, it's...
Cutting the grass is interesting, because when you cut the grass, you have this wonderful garlic chive smell.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you hungry. But so what do I do? Is there any way I can control this without killing the whole garden?
Yes, yes. Now, the areas where they're popping up, are you sure that it is the same plant as your chives, or could it be wild onion and wild garlic?
No, it is the garlic chive.
Okay, because yeah. I think you're letting them go to flower and then go to seed is how they're spreading, because they're bulbing plants, they're clumping plants, but they're not running plants like bamboo or my raspberries. If they're coming up 3 or 6 feet away, it's because the seed is being dispersed. So in the areas where you don't want them, there is a tool that I often recommend for this kind of problem. Generally, we recommend it for Star of Bethlehem, wild onion, wild garlic. But your garlic chives are an actual allium. They have a big bulb down at the bottom. Then they have a root system, and they tend to grow in clumps, right?
Yeah, when they do spring up, there's a 3 to 6 to 12 inch circle here and circle there, and
yeah, because they will
along the edge of the house.
Right, because they'll actually procreate underground as well. They will put out little bulblets off of the parent bulb underground and multiply that way. As well as spreading the seed. So there's a tool. The only place I know you can get it is a place called Lee Valley Tools. And they're online at Lee Valley, L-E-E. And it's a great device. I'm surprised you don't see it all over the place. It's called the water-powered weeder. It's a very long tapering tube that comes to a sharp point, comes in sections. You screw it together. And then you attach it to your hose, and where you attach it to your hose, there's a big trigger at the top. So you turn your water pressure on full blast, you poke the spiky end down into the ground next to the clump of garlic chives, and you pull the trigger. And it shoots this incredibly concentrated blast of water right into the root system. Not only makes it very easy to pull the weed out of the ground, sometimes the whole clump just pops right up out of the ground for you.
Okay.
So you can,
that would be wonderful.
Exactly. You can do that to take care of your outliers. And then what I would also suggest is if you want to see the flowers, that's fine. But a day or two after they first appear, either use a flame weeder to torch them off or go out and pluck the flowers off by hand so you don't get any more seed dispersing around your property.
All right. Well, that is extremely helpful. Thank you so much. I'll get my herb garden under control again.
Okay. You take care.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good, Rob. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Hey, second time listener, first time caller.
Okay, very good. Where is Rob calling from?
Hershey, Pennsylvania.
The Chocolate City.
You got it. Sweetest place on earth.
All right, Rob. What can we do for Rob and Hershey?
Well, I got an invasive bamboo. I just moved here, bought a house with invasive bamboo. Me and my nephew, we dug up about 50 shoots that were coming off this main clump, and I had a contractor come in and lift up, dig out that clump, and I'm
busy
hauling it away at present. Got a couple questions for you. One is, I'm going to have a big gap where that clump was, a big hole. Do I dirt and seed it or mulch it? Second question is, can I take this to the dump where they turn it into mulch?
For God's sake, don't throw it into the woods because it'll start to root.
Right.
So, yes, because it is green waste, you're kind of limited. If they see you and say, we can't take this, then you're going to have to figure out some way to have a controlled burn pile, you know, find out what the local regulations are. And it would be a sin. But yes, I mean, they should be able to shred it up and make it safe again, composting it in a hot pile. But you had a guy come out with a backhoe.
Yes.
And are you sure you got everything out?
Oh, absolutely not.
Oh, okay.
And there's no visible. And we got out some big rhizomes, like 6, 8, 10 feet.
Right.
But some of them just break while you're pulling them. So
right.
I'm sure there's still some left behind.
Right. So that's the deal. What you saw, that grove of bamboo, that's one plant. It's all one giant root system. Think of the culms
right.
that come up out of the ground as branches of a tree. So you probably want to continue to keep excavating. Don't fill anything in yet. Now, if you've contained it somehow to a nice part of the property, because it is beautiful if it can be contained, if you've stopped the spread into areas where it would threaten the structure of your house or where you want to have a garden, you can have a landscaper come in and professionally install what's called rhizome barrier that will keep it inside a dedicated area. Then you can kind of have your bamboo and eat it too.
You know, that's interesting. When I had a gentleman from Thailand tell me you can boil the roots and eat them.
When the first new shoots come up, those are bamboo shoots. Those are the bamboo shoots that are used in Chinese cuisine. To get the best taste, you make sure they don't get exposed to the sun. You cover them right away. You blanch them. But yes, very young shoots of bamboo are bamboo shoots. They're a Chinese vegetable. So anyway, your options are to surround an area that you like with rhizome barrier, which should be professionally installed, because if you don't get the seams exactly right, it'll get messed up. Or to keep backhoeing it out until you're pretty sure you've got it all. Now, their technique of constantly mowing it, once you've really attacked the main plant, gotten out a lot of roots, if there's a little bit left behind and you keep mowing them down, that will control them. I have bamboo near my property, and the neighbor next door to me, all he does to control its spread is constantly mow it down. And it has not advanced in the 35 years I've lived in this house. So that can be done. But your options are get rid of it completely before you plant anything else in there. Put in a rhizome barrier and have a beautiful bamboo garden that's contained. Or, you know, make sure you know where it ends. And then what I would do is be ready to mow constantly. And when you replant the area where you got the big thing out of, put in something that is just as tenacious as the bamboo. That sounds like a great place for a raspberry patch. Something that would also spread underground, but that would give you even better eating than the bamboo shoots.
Great.
Oh, and let me give you a resource. There is a website called AmericanBamboo.org. They are the experts on what's called running bamboo, and they have all sorts of information about the rhizome barriers, people who can install it, what it would cost you, different ways to attack it. They're great people.
Hey, appreciate it, Mike.
All right, good luck, Rob. Stay sweet.
Have a good day.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Josh, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing?
I am doing just ducky today, Josh. Thank you for asking. How are you, sir?
Very well. Just wanted to thank you for taking my call and question.
Well, thank you for making it. Where are you, man?
I'm calling from Chester, New Jersey.
Chester, New Jersey. I know Chester, Pennsylvania. Where is Chester, New Jersey?
It's sort of near Morristown, on 206,
okay.
Kind of northern New Jersey.
Boy, whenever somebody from Jersey, that sooner, very quickly, when you ask them where they are, you either get a route number or an exit, you know?
Yeah, we're kind of like out in the sticks a little bit of North Jersey.
Okay. What can we do for Josh in Chester, New Jersey?
Well, my question, Mike, was about kind of how to put the field to rest for the winter. I run a small market garden. We have 90 permanent beds.
Excellent.
We, you know, heavy on the compost, trying to build up the soil as much as possible while working it as least as we can. And my question is, for stuff like spinach, lettuce mix, kale, all the brassicas and other stuff that, you know, you can kind of keep in and as long as you can and cover with frost cloth and stuff, what would you recommend that I do for those beds as far as a cover crop situation or putting the beds to rest? You know, stuff that you leave in a lot longer than, you know, say the tomatoes and stuff that you're taking out now.
Right. So you're not growing in high tunnels or hoop houses yet.
No. Well, we do have some stuff in a couple tunnels, but I'm mainly concerned about the stuff outside, like the brassicas and the leafy greens and the carrots that I can have in, you know, until around November and cover with frost cloth. But by then, there's not enough daylight to germ like a lot of the cover crop.
Right, or soil temperature.
Right, exactly. So I was just wondering, you know, because I know it's really bad to have soil just bare and have nothing going on, and especially through the winter with the snow melting and leaching the nitrogen and nutrients. What do other small market gardens do in situations like this?
Well, what this small gardener does, I got 22 raised beds and 1,000 square feet of raspberries, so I'm small time compared to you. I legendarily shred up the equivalent of hundreds of bags of shredded fall leaves as they come down all
right
around my neighborhood. And what I do is the beds that are now empty, the ones where tomatoes came out of and garlic didn't go into or they're not growing some sort of perennial or cold weather crop, they get covered with 2 inches of shredded leaves, which does a great job of keeping the soil in place, keeping the nutrients in the soil, preventing weed growth. And at first, at least for me, an unexpected side benefit is when you pull away that leaf mulch in the spring, you will find that every earthworm in the area has colonized that area underneath the shredded leaves, because leaf litter is their natural habitat. And
okay,
they have been feeding the soil. They have been grinding up that lousy clay soil and pooping out super-duper compost in its place.
Right.
So that's one answer. And the other answer is next season, what you probably want to do is let some beds be done by September and then sow the cover crop of your choice, whether it's something that's going to winter kill, and then you just punch holes in that living dead mulch in the spring and put in things like tomatoes and peppers. That works great, by the way.
What about underselling a cover crop with, say, you know, something you would get a little later into the summer, into the fall, if you could like undersow some kind of oats or radishes in beds of tomatoes, or even use like silage tarps? I know that has kind of been like a topic being kind of experimented with recently. It's just putting down these big silage tarps that would cover, I don't know, 6 or 10 beds that I have at the farm, and then in the spring you would just kind of peel them off.
Yeah, see, I kind of prefer the individual shredded leaves for that, because then when you rake back, and the thing with shredded leaves, if you're going to use those as your winter mulch, you know, get them off the beds early in the spring, because they will keep the soil cool. But
right,
if you do what I'm saying, you pull that mulch off for like 10 days to let the soil warm up, you plant your crops, then you just put it back in place as a weed-preventing mulch. The earthworms come in. They will improve your soil as much as a tilled-in cover crop, and they'll help you with your weed problems, which, in my experience, are the biggest problem in an organic garden or farm.
Right. No, for sure. We battle the weeds all day. We try to cultivate more than weed, because we always say if you're weeding, you've missed the chance to cultivate, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the classic cover crop otherwise is something you sow in, like, September. It grows up and it stays, quote, alive over the winter. But then you do have to till it into the soil in the spring, and that's, quote, green manure. Because
right,
that's a green plant. It might have been nitrogen fixing, But because it's high nitrogen, it's not tying up nitrogen in the soil. Leaves being high carbon, they're going to tie up your soil nutrients. They're great on the surface, but not mixed in.
Okay, well, that's very good advice. I really appreciate it. So basically, get on some fall leaves as soon as possible in the spring, rake them off the top, wait, I don't know, 10 days to 2 weeks, and then get going all over again.
Yeah. Exactly. And you'll be amazed at the earthworm action you get, the free fertilizer they're going to provide.
Great. Well, that is invaluable information. I really appreciate it, Mike, for taking the call and giving me the advice. You know, like I said, we've been doing the farm there. This is like the sixth year, but we really didn't get enough momentum to kind of quit your day job, so to speak, until 2 years ago. So, and we're always trying to improve our methods and like I said, work the soil as least as possible. But we're trying to basically turn the farm into like the forest floor. You know?
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that's the way to do it, man. That is the forest floor.
Yes. So, again, I really appreciate the advice and I have a good feeling about it. So thank you so much again.
Well, thank you for being a farmer, Josh. We need you guys.
Thank you.
All right. You take care, man.
You too. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody in the mid-Atlantic and northern areas that tomato time is done. Give it up, folks. Pick off all your big greenies, bring them inside to ripen up or make fried green tomatoes, shred the old plants into your compost pile, and plant salad greens, pansies, and other plants that like cold weather in their place. But don't go bewailing your beefsteak bereavedness just yet, because we'll be right back with bad wood, unenforced laws, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the, quote, question of the week, which this week is not so much a question as a series of demands to yours truly to change his tone about the use of old railroad ties in the home landscape. Will he do it? Will he stand fast? You'll find out after a couple of more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to have you here. Where are you, sir?
I'm calling from Wincote, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. Very good. What can we do for Tom in Wincote?
I'm calling actually because we just moved into the house, and it has a nice little, about an acre property. fairly wooded. There's a yard, and then there's a and lots of tall old trees, 90, 80 foot trees, mostly tulip poplars. We're very interested in planting back there and sort of around the property. We really like crepe myrtle trees. I was wondering, A, how they do in this area, and B, if we were to plant them, how exactly we should go about that, when, that kind of thing. I'm fairly new to landscaping and gardening in general.
So it's so funny you asked, Tom, because 10, 20 years ago, I would have said, well, crepe myrtles aren't reliably hardy in Pennsylvania. But boy, has that changed with Krypton becoming unstable. Global warming, climate change, whatever you want to call it, has expanded the northern range of these trees quite a bit. Crepe myrtles come in a number of different forms. If you ever drive down Route 13, go down the Eastern Shore in Virginia, you'll see massive crepe myrtles that are almost the size of your tulip poplars.
Okay.
That are single-trunked trees. There are also dwarf versions of those. And then a very popular style is a shrub that consists of 10, 20, 30, 40 little tree trunks all coming out of the same root system.
Okay.
Crepe myrtles can be planted in the spring or in the fall. They are literally almost the last plant to bloom in the landscape. They are very much late summer bloomers. They come in at a time when people are dying for some fresh color. The only issue you've described, kind of doing what I did back in the 80s, foolishly buying Snow White's old house in the woods and thinking you could garden there. I mean, it's great when the chipmunks and the birds come in and do your dishes, but you realize that you are greatly limited by those, especially tulip poplars. They are monster trees, but, you know, they grow up nice and straight, don't they, Tom?
Yes, they do, and then they drop big branches from very high up. So,
that's their specialty. Yep, you got the right tree. So the only limiting factor anymore with a crepe myrtle is going to be largely sunlight. Do you have any areas where these trees will get enough sun to flower?
That's actually a good point. I mean, I think our front yard, and we have a big magnolia in the front yard, but I think there's certainly more room out there, and it is more exposed. There's less of the really tall trees that really provide a ton of shade. But that's actually one of my questions. So that's actually good to know. If we stay towards the front, then maybe we do a little bit better as far as sun exposure.
Most flowering plants flower best or only flower at all if they get a lot of sun. But as long as they get 6 or 8 hours of sun a day, they'll do fine. I would probably recommend you look at the smaller varieties, the multi-branching shrubs, to make the best use of your space. And the secret to crepe myrtle production is whether you plant them in the spring or the fall, they will bloom in late summer, then leave them alone until the plant begins regrowing again in the spring. About 2 weeks after it starts new green growth, cut off the amount that the plant grew the year before. If you started the summer with a 6-foot-high plant and it ended up at 8-foot-high, the next year in the spring, cut it back to 6 feet. Let it grow those 2 feet and flower. Boom, same thing. Some people will tell you to cut it all the way back to the ground. That's crepe murder. And you'll end up with trunks that are fat at the bottom and skinny on top, and it looks awful. So prune, but you should prune lightly in the spring. Even if you only take off 6 inches or so, that will help you get more flowers, even if the sun situation is a tiny bit on the dicey side.
Okay. No, that's extremely helpful.
All right. Good luck, sir.
I appreciate it, Mike. Thanks again.
Take care, man.
Okay. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you.
My pleasure to have you with us. David, where are you, man?
I'm in Londonderry, Vermont. God's country.
A beautiful area up there. Yeah, I've heard of Londonderry. All right, very good. What can we do for David up in Vermont?
So So I have a small pasture where I transplanted about 20, 25 years ago some very small birch saplings.
Right.
And most of them survived okay until the ice storms got them.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them have done really well for 25 years. It's quite good for a birch. However, they're being attacked by a beetle, it appears. I don't know if it's a beetle. You tell me. They're being attacked from the top, and they're dying from the top over months. And you can almost, you feel like you can watch them die, the progression as they, as this disease comes down from the top of the tree and basically removes all its leaves and it turns sort of brown. And I chopped one of them down because it was dead in the pasture, and I was told by someone not to use it for fire, which I wished I could have. So I chopped it down and burnt it.
Right.
I have one more that I need to do. So the question is, what's happening? Can I stop it? I don't think so. And can I burn it if I have to kill it?
So this is the last of the birches, huh?
Last of the ones in the pasture, yeah.
Okay.
I'll plant some more.
Now, before you made your giant bonfire, did you inspect the wood?
Yeah, it looks fine to me. Sure, I cut it into, you know, haulable pieces, yeah.
And you didn't see any, quote, wormholes or the distinctive trails through the bark that bark-eating beetles would make?
No, I did not.
I think you got bad advice, and you missed out on like a tenth of a cord of firewood, man.
Help me out. Help me.
I think you should have burned it inside your house. The advice you were given is there are a lot of wood-boring beetles around right now. One of the worst is the emerald ash borer, but there are many others that are attacking different trees. The bottom line here is once the top of a tree starts to die, the tree is dead.
Okay.
Because as you know, the top of the tree is the newest growth.
Okay.
And, you know, the sides in the middle can hold out for a while, but if it's dying from the top down, it's just going to be a hazard for dropping branches as it goes into its slow decline. So, you know, certainly if you hope to even burn some of it late this winter, you want to take that puppy down right away to start seasoning it, right?
Yeah.
So here's the deal. The parts of the tree that are still, quote, healthy, I'm just going to say we're at 50-50. The top half is dead. The bottom half still has some leafy branches on it.
Yeah.
So the part with the leafy branches, I mean, take a look at it and everything, but that would sure seem to be okay. When you get to the dead wood at the top, inspect it carefully. Borers leave a trail. They actually bore into the wood. So the advice you were given to burn the wood is if beetles were infested in it, there'd be eggs in there, and the wood needs to be destroyed immediately so that next generation can't come out and start infesting other trees. But if you see no sign of infestation, and you sound like the kind of guy who's going to look pretty carefully and the damage is pretty obvious, then the trees just died from old age or a disease or, as you say, ice storm damage, which takes out more trees than people realize. The bottom line is if you see no sign of infestation, it is safe to season and use as firewood when the time comes around. But if you see any signs of infestation, yeah, burn that wood right away. And, you know, keep an eye on it while it's seasoning. If you see anything funny, you can jump. But, you know, the fact that you didn't see anything on that other tree leads me to believe this one's going to be okay, too.
Thank you for your advice.
All right, David.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Old railroad tie redo. Just don't use them. Alexis Landis, get us started with this week's not so much question, but comment.
No problem. George in America's Georgia writes, in the article in your A to Z archives concerning the use of railroad ties for landscaping, you say incorrectly that this practice is illegal. Even your own EPA link on the subject states that the agency does not approve creosote wood for home or landscape use. That means they don't recommend it. It is only illegal to use creosote-based pesticides, according to the link. State and local restrictions may apply. But I sold building materials for 20 years in Georgia, and to the best of my knowledge, it has never been illegal here. Please correct your mistake for your readers and listeners. Mistake? Sounds more like semantics, or at best, a difference of opinion on some legal wording. Is one email enough to have you bring this topic up again?
No, Georgia's only one of many. We've gotten a flurry of emails recently asking me to, quote, correct my mistake about old railroad ties being illegal for home use. It may be a coincidence, but the wordings are strangely similar. Take a look at this one.
Anthony, just north of Seattle, writes, "Thanks for the article on railroad ties in your A to Z archives. But unless I'm mistaken, the term illegal is a stretch. To my understanding, no approved use does not mean something is unlawful. Occasionally, I'm called upon to write a blog post, and it pains me when I'm less than accurate. If you don't suffer from this affliction, well, thank you again and have a nice day." Yikes, you're right. That wording is very similar, and it comes off a little rude.
Well, that was my first impression, too. But things changed after he received my response, where I simply said, actually, the use of any pesticide product, which these timbers are, outside of their labeled and permitted use, is a violation of federal law. And, you know, I was a little miffed, so I added that I didn't see the point in mincing words in a way that might lead some people to believe that these giant sticks of cancer are safe to use. His response reminded me that it's really easy to read, or in this case maybe misread, feelings and intents in an email.
He wrote back, "Thanks for your response. I subsequently found a discussion on a legal board where the statute in question is referenced and quoted as EPA considers such uses of creosote-treated wood to be illegal under FIFRA 12A2G. Okay, that sure seems to be an amazing attitudinal turnaround. Maybe we were reading too much into his initial email? Now, explain that citation.
Well, those five letters, FIFRA, stand for the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act.
Rodenticide?
Yeah, you know, like in rat poison. And while we're on the subject of things you should not use, let's include those. Because if you do manage to poison a rat or a mouse and it goes outside to die, you could wind up collaterally killing an owl, a fox, a raptor, or some other predator that would otherwise have consumed hundreds, maybe thousands of such vermin over its lifetime. And if the mousy or ratty crawls inside your walls to take its last breath, you will be reminded of your folly in an unforgettable, olfactory manner for many weeks, perhaps months to come.
Yuck!
Double yuck. Anyway, FIFRA, in conjunction with the EPA, dictates specifically when and how you're allowed to use insecticides, fungicides, and rodenticides, what's technically known as the label. And nobody is allowed to go off-label. It is, quote, a violation of federal law to use this product in a matter for which it is not intended.
And old railroad ties are specifically not intended for homeowner or landscaping use. But listeners are always sending you photos of them for sale at lumber yards and home stores.
And to use those timbers in a home landscape is a violation of federal law. But laws and regulations are meaningless if they're not enforced.
But these things are dangerous.
Old railroad ties and telephone poles have historically been treated with creosote and/or a substance known by the shorthand penta, both of which are classified as either known or probable human carcinogens. And yet a number of people have been writing me lately to say, well, it might be technically illegal, but it isn't spelled out directly, so you should stop saying that.
Ha! You tell people not to use a lot of things that are technically legal if you follow the directions on the label.
Right. 7 and other chemical insecticides, Roundup and other chemical herbicides. I want people to know that just because something might be legal, it doesn't mean that it's safe. Old railroad ties are unsafe and illegal. And in case nobody's getting the point, just don't use giant sticks of cancer in your landscape. And if they're already there, don't grow food near them or touch them with bare skin.
Well, why do you think there's a sudden surge of emails?
I'm guessing it's because of internet searches. Some people really want to use these things in their landscape. But let's say a spouse or a partner wisely objects and makes them do some research first. When I checked yesterday, our previous article on the topic is right up at the top of those internet searches. Well, that sure was some laying of the track now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to question my legality if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location and where you will probably find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to email us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our webpage street legal. Our law-abiding intern is Alicia Lester. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, could not get arrested if she tried. We do not advise our editor, Al Banks, to try. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I have never been convicted of a federal crime. I'm very proud of that. It's right at the top of my resume. LinkedIn profile, too. You know, other people, LinkedIn titles or stuff like vice president of bloody blah. But if they've never been convicted of a federal crime, why isn't right up at the top for them? Whoops, have to go. There's a couple of guys in suits and dark glasses at the door with paperwork in their hand. Hey, but I bet you I'll beat the rap and see you again next week. Rock mulch would be a great name for a band, but does it make sense in a flower bed? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll review the realities of trying to prevent weeds with river rock. Plus your fabulous phone calls.